Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Ubal Sathla by Clark Ashton Smith. For Ubal Sathla is the source and the end. Before the coming of Xothakwa, or Yog-Sothoth, or Kithhut from the stars, Ubal Sathla dwelt in the steaming fens of the new-made earth, a mass without head or members, spawning the gray, formless efts of the prime and the grisly prototypes of terrene life. And all earthly life, it is told, shall go back at last through the great circle of time to Ubal Sathla, from the Book of Ibon. Paul Tregartis found the milky crystal in a litter of oddments from many lands and eras. He had entered the shop of the curio dealer through an aimless impulse with no object in mind, other than the idle distraction of eyeing and fingering a miscellany of far-gathered things. Looking desultorily about, his attentions had been drawn by a dull glimmering on one of the tables, and he had extricated the queer orb-like stone from its shadowy, crowded position between an ugly little Aztec idol, the fossil egg of a Denornis, and an obscene fetish of black wood from the Niger. The thing was about the size of a small orange and was slightly flattened at the ends, like a planet at its poles. It puzzled Tregartis, for it was not like an ordinary crystal, being cloudy and changeable, with an intermittent glowing in its heart, as if it were alternately illumined and darkened from within. Holding it to the wintry window, he studied it for a while, without being able to determine the secret of the singular and regular alternation. His puzzlement was soon complicated by a dawning sense of vague and irreconcilable familiarity, as if he had seen the thing before, under circumstances that were now wholly forgotten. He appealed to the curio dealer, a dwarfish man with an air of dusty antiquity, who gave the impression of being lost to commercial considerations in some web of cabalistic reverie. "Can you tell me anything about this?" The dealer gave an indescribable simultaneous shrug of the shoulders and his eyebrows. "It is very old. Paleo-Aegean, one might say. I cannot tell you much, for little is known. A geologist found it in Greenland, beneath glacial ice, in the Miocene strata. Who knows? It may have belonged to some sorcerer of primeval Thule. Greenland was a warm, fertile region, beneath the sun of Miocene times. No doubt it is a magic crystal, and a man might behold strange visions in its heart, if he looked long enough." Tregartis was quite startled, for the dealer's apparently fantastic suggestion had brought to mind his own delvings in a branch of obscure lore, and in particular had recalled the Book of Ibon, the strangest and rarest of occult forgotten volumes, which is said to have come down through a series of manifold translations from a prehistoric original written in the lost language of Hyperborea. Tregartis, with much difficulty, had obtained the medieval French version, a copy that had been owned by many generations of sorcerers and Satanists, but had never been able to find the Greek manuscript from which the version was derived. The remote, fabulous original was supposed to have been the work of a great Hyperborean wizard from whom it had taken its name. It was a collection of dark and baleful myths, of liturgies, rituals, and incantations both evil and esoteric. Not without shudders, in the course of studies that the average person would have considered more than singular, Tregartis had collated the French volume with the frightful Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul Azared. He had found many correspondences of the blackest and most appalling significance, together with much forbidden data that was either unknown to the Arab or omitted by him, or by his translators. Was this what he had been trying to recall? Tregardis wondered. The brief, casual reference in the Book of Ibon to cloudy crystal that had been owned by the wizard Zahn Mezamalik and Muthulan. Of course, was all too fantastic, too hypothetic, too incredible. But Muthulan, that northern portion of ancient Hyperborea, was supposed to have corresponded roughly with modern Greenland, which had formerly been joined as a peninsula to the main continent. Could the stone in his hand, by some fabulous fortuity, be the crystal of Zahn Mezamalik? Tregarda smiled at himself, with inward irony, for even conceiving the absurd notion, such things did not occur. At least, not in present-day London, and in all likelihood the Book of Ibon was sheer superstitious fantasy anyway. Nevertheless, there was something about the crystal that continued to tease and inveigle him. He ended by purchasing it at a fairly moderate price. The sum was named by the seller and paid by the buyer without bargaining. With a crystal in his pocket, Paul Tregardis hastened back to his lodgings instead of resuming his leisurely saunter. He installed the milky globe on his writing table, where it stood firmly enough on one of its oblate ends. Then, still smiling at his own absurdity, he took down the yellow parchment manuscript of the Book of Ibon from its place in a somewhat inclusive collection of recherche literature. He opened the vernaculated leather, covered with hasps of tarnished steel, and read over to himself, translating from the archaic French as he read the paragraph that reserved to Zahn Mezamalik. This wizard, who was mighty among sorcerers, had found a cloudy stone, orb-like and somewhat flattened at the ends, in which he could behold many visions of the terrene past, even to the earth's beginning, when Ubal Sathla, the unbegotten source, lay vast and swollen and yeastly amid the vaporing slime. But of that which he beheld, Zahn Mezamalik left little record, and people say that he vanished presently in a way that is not known, and after him the cloudy crystal was lost. Paul Tregardis laid the manuscript aside. Again, there was something that tantalized and beguiled him, like a lost dream or a memory forfeit to oblivion. Impelled by a feeling which he did not scrutinize or question, he sat down before the table and began to stare intently into the cold, nebulous orb. He felt an expectation which somehow was so familiar, so permeative a part of his consciousness that he did not even name it to himself. Minute by minute he sat and watched the alternate glimmering and fading of the mysterious light in the heart of the crystal. By imperceptible degrees, there stole upon him a sense of dreamlike duality, both in respect to his person and his surroundings. He was still Paul Tregardis, and yet he was someone else. The room was his London apartment and chamber in some foreign but well-known place, and in both Milius he peered steadfastly into the same crystal. After an interim, without surprise on the part of Tregardis, the process of re-identification became complete. He knew that he was Zahn Mezamalik, a sorcerer of Muthulan, and a student of all lore anterior to his own epoch, wise with dreadful secrets that were not known to Paul Tregardis, amateur of anthropology and the occult sciences in latter-day London. He sought by means of the milky crystal to attain an even older and more fearful knowledge. He had acquired the stone in dutiable ways, from a more than sinister source. It was unique and without fellow in any land or time. In its death, all former years, all things that had ever been, were supposedly mirrored and would reveal themselves to the patient visionary. And through the crystal, Zahn Mezamalik had dreamt to recover the wisdom of the gods who died before the earth was born. They had passed to the lightless void, leaving their lore inscribed upon tablets of ultrastellar stone, and the tablets were guarded in the primal mire by the formless idiotic demiurge, Ubal Sathla. Only by means of the crystal could he hope to find and read the tablets. For the first time, he was making trial of the globe's reputed virtues. About him, an ivory-paneled chamber, filled with his magic books and paraphernalia, was fading slowly from his consciousness. Before him, on a table of some dark Hyperborean wood that had been graven with grotesque ciphers. The crystal appeared to swell and deepen, and its filmy death he beheld a swift and broken swirling of dim scenes fleeting like the bubbles of a mill race, as if he looked upon an actual world, cities, forests, mountains, seas, and meadows flowed beneath him, lightening and darkening as with the passage of days and nights in some weirdly accelerated stream of time. Zahn Mazamelic had forgotten Paul Tregartis, had lost the remembrance of his own entity and his own surroundings in Mu Tulan. Moment by moment, the flowing vision in the crystal became more definite and distinct, and the orb itself deepened till he grew giddy, as if he were peering from an insecure height into some never-fathomed abyss. He knew that time was racing backward in the crystal, was unrolling for him the pageant of all past days, but a strange alarm had seized him, and he feared to gaze longer. Like one who has nearly fallen from a precipice, he caught himself with a violent start and drew back from the mystic orb. Again to his gaze, the enormous whirling world into which he had peered with a small and cloudy crystal on his rune-wrought table in Mu Tulan. Then by degree it seemed that the great room with sculptured panels of mammoth ivory was narrowing to another and dingier place, and Zahn Mazamelic, losing his preternatural wisdom and sorcerer's power, went back by a weird regression into Paul Tregartis. And yet, not wholly, it seemed, was he able to return. Tregartis, dazed and wondering, found himself before the writing table on which he had set the oblate sphere. He felt the confusion of one who has dreamt and has not yet fully awakened from the dream. The room puzzled him vaguely, as if something were wrong with its size and furnishing, and his remembrance of purchasing the crystal from a curio dealer was oddly and indescribably mingled with an impression that he had acquired it in a very different manner. He felt that something very strange had happened to him when he peered into the crystal, but just what it was he could not seem to recollect. It had left him in a sort of psychic muddlement that follows the debauch of hashish. He assured himself that he was Paul Tregartis, that he lived on a certain street in London, that the year was 1933, but such commonplace verities had somehow lost their meaning and their validity, and everything about him was shadow-like and insubstantial. The very walls seemed to waver like smoke. The people in the streets were phantoms of phantoms, and he himself was a lost shadow, a wandering echo of something long forgot. He resolved that he would not repeat his experiment of crystal gazing. The effect was too unpleasant and equivocal. But the very next day, by an unreasoning impulse to which he yielded almost mechanically, without reluction, he found himself seated before the misty orb. Again he became the sorcerer Zahn Mazamelic in Mu Tulan. Again he dreamt to retrieve the wisdom of the anti-mundane gods. Again he drew back from the deepening crystal with the terror of one who fears to fall. And once more, but doubtfully and dimly, like a failing wraith, he was Paul Tregartis. Three times did Tregartis repeat the experience on successive days, and each time his own person and the world about him became more tenuous and confused than before. His sensations were those of a dreamer who was on the verge of waking, and London itself was unreal as the lands that slipped from the dreamer's ken, receding in filmy mist and cloudy light. Beyond it all, he felt the looming and crowding of vast imageries, alien but half familiar. It was as if the phantasmagoria of time and space were dissolving about him to reveal some veritable reality, or another dream of space and time. There came at last the day when he sat down before the crystal and did not return as Paul Tregartis. It was the day when Zahn Mazamelic, boldly disregarding certain evil and portentous warnings, resolved to overcome his curious fear of falling bodily into the visionary world that he beheld, a fear that had hitherto prevented him from following the backward stream of time from any distance. He must, he assured himself, conquer his fear if he were ever to see and read the lost tablets of the gods. He had beheld nothing more than a few fragments of the years of Mu Tulan, immediately posterior to the present, the years of his own lifetime, and they were inestimable cycles between these years and the beginning. Again to his gaze, the crystal deepened immeasurably, with scenes and happenings that flowed in a retrograde stream. Again the magic ciphers of the dark table faded from his ken, and the sorcerously carven walls of his chamber melted into less than dream. Once more he grew giddy with an awful vertigo as he bent above the swirling and milling of the terrible gulfs of time in the world-like orb. Fearfully, in spite of his resolution, he would have drawn away, but he had looked and leaned too long. There was a sense of abysmal falling, a suction of inexorable winds, of maelstroms that bore him down through fleet, unstable visions of his own past life into antenatal years and dimensions. He seemed to endure the pangs of an inverse dissolution, and then he was no longer Zahn Mezamelic, the wise and learned watcher of the crystal, but an actual part of the weirdly racing stream that ran back to reattain the beginning. He seemed to live a numbered lives, to die myriad deaths, forgetting each time the death and life that had gone before. He fought as a warrior in half-legendary battles. He was a child playing in the ruins of some olden city of Mutulan. He was the king who had reigned when the city was in its prime, the prophet who had foretold its building and its doom. A woman, he wept for the bygone dead in necropoli long crumbled. An antique wizard, he muttered the rude spells of earlier sorcery. A priest of some prehuman god, he wielded the sacrificial knife in cave temples of pillared basalt. Life by life, era by era, he retraced the long and groping cycles through which Hyperborea had risen from savagery to a high civilization. He became a barbarian of some troglodytic tribe, fleeing from the slow, turreted ice of a former glacial age into lands illuminated by the ruddy flare of perpetual volcanoes. Then after incomputable years, he was no longer man, but a man-like beast, roving in forests of giant fern and calamite, or building an uncouth net in the bows of mighty Kasaiads. Through eons of interior sensation, of crude lust and hunger, of aboriginal terror and madness, there was someone, or something, that went ever backward in time. Death became birth, and birth was death. In a slow vision of reverse change, the earth appeared to melt away, to slow off the hills and mountains of its latter strata. Always the sun grew larger and hotter above the fuming swamps that teem with a crasser life, with a more fulsome vegetation. And the thing that had been Paul Tregardis, that had been Zahn Mezamelic, was a part of all the monstrous devolution. It flew with the claw-tipped wing of a pterodactyl. It swam in tepid seas with the vast winding bulk of Ichthyosaurus. It bellowed uncouthly with the armored throat of some forgotten behemoth to the huge moon that burned through Liassic mist. At length, after eons of immemorial brutehood, it became one of the lost serpent men who reared their cities of black gneiss and fought their venomous wars in the world's first continent. It walked unjustly in anti-human streets, and strange crooked vaults appeared at primeval stars from high Babylonian towers. It bowed with hissing litanies to great serpent idols. Through years and ages of the Ophidian era, it returned and was a thing that crawled in the ooze, that had yet not learned to think and dream and build. And the time came when there was no longer a continent, but only a vast chaotic marsh, a sea of slime without limit or horizon, that seethed with a blind writhing of amorphous vapors. There, in the gray beginning of earth, the formless mass that was Ubu Safla reposed amid the slime and the vapors. Headless, without organs or members, it slowed from its oozy sides in a slow, ceaseless wave, the amoebic forms that were the archetypes of earthly life. Horrible it was, if there had been aught to apprehend a horror, and loathsome, if there had been any to feel loathing. About it, prone or tilted in the mire, there lay the mighty tablets of star-quarried stone that were writ with the inconceivable wisdom of the pre-mundane gods. And there, to the goal of a forgotten search, was drawn the thing that had been, or would be some time be, Paul Tregardis and Zahn Mezamelic, becoming a shapeless eft of the prime. It crawled sluggishly and obliviously across the fallen tablets of the gods, and fought and Raven blindly were the other spawn of Ubosathla, of Zan Mezamelek, and his vanishing there is no mention anywhere, save the brief passage in the Book of Ibon. Concerning Paul Tregardis, who also disappeared, there was a curt notice in several London papers. No one seems to have known anything about him. He is gone as if he had never been, and the crystal presumably is gone too. At least, no one has found it. The Watcher in the Green Room by Hugh B. Cave. The plump, stumpy man in the double-breasted greatcoat was quite obviously drunk. He walked with an exaggerated shuffle, which carried him perilously close to the edge of the high curbing, whereupon he stopped short, drew his fat hands from their respective pockets, and gravely regarded the drooling gutter beneath him. Proceeding sluggishly in this manner, he successfully navigated 3 blocks of gleaming sidewalk, turned left into Peterborough Street, and arrived before a red brick apartment building whose square front frowned down upon him with disapproving solemnity. He stood staring, apparently unaware that the hour was midnight and that the rain, which had fallen steadily since early evening, had made of him a drenched, disheveled streetwalker. Before him, as he stood thus contemplating the wide entrance, the door opened and a man and a woman descended the stone steps. They gazed at him queerly. The man spoke. "Drunk again, Colet?" "Still," the drunken one replied, grinning. "You'd better let Frank help you," the woman advised. "You'll be invading the wrong apartment again." The plump man raised one hand up and out in a clumsy salute. "A camel," he said, "never forgets." The man and woman hesitated. In undertone, the man muttered, "Poor devil. It's too bad. I suppose it's the easiest way to forget." The drunken one did not hear. He grinned idiotically as the man and woman went their way, leaving him to ascend the steps alone. In the lobby, he groped in the pockets of his coat and produced a key ring. Mechanically, he thrust 2 fingers into the brass mailed box marked Anthony Colet. Then, opening the heavy inner door with a key proportionately large, he marched down the corridor, climbed 2 flights of rubber-carpeted stairs, and let himself into an apartment number 31. 5 days gone, he mumbled, closing the door behind him. "If they haven't found out by now, they never will." The thought sobered him, but he was still drunk enough to fumble awkwardly for the light switch. The bright light blinded him. Blinking, he groped down the short hall to the living room and lowered himself heavily, coat and all, into an overstuffed chair close to the radio. Reaching out, he lit the lamp on the end table beside him. Then he stretched himself, relaxed, and gazed intently at a large gray photograph which stared at him serenely from atop the radio. The photograph was of a woman, attractive, straight-haired, somber-eyed, perhaps 30 years of age. It stood formally in a square silver frame, bare of ornamentation or inscription. The plump man studied it without emotion, as if he had studied it precisely the same way a great many times before. Presently he rose, removed his wet garments and shoes, and walked near naked into the adjoining room. When he returned, he held a bottle and glass in his hands. He filled the glass, raised it toward the photograph, and said quietly, "Pleasant dreams." Then he turned out the light and paced unsteadily into the bedroom. The bedroom was small and square, boasting a wooden 3/4 bed, a squat table, a massive old-fashioned bureau, and a single yellow curtained window. The plump man sat on the bed and removed his socks. He stared at the bureau, grinned cruelly, and said, "Too big, Old style, is it? Well, it's a good thing it was big. Otherwise, you'd be kind of cramped for room, sweetheart. For once, you won't complain, huh?" The bed was unmade. He climbed into it and shaped the pillow with his fist, then lay on his back and gazed at the ceiling. The room was not quite dark. Its single window was high above the street outside and level with the roof of a building across the way. The wet window pane exuded a green glow, reflecting the pale glare of a neon sign on the nearby roof. The glow was pleasant. The plump man enjoyed looking at it. It made fantastic green edge shapes on the walls of the room and transformed the huge bureau in the corner into a monstrous 4-legged beast. He liked the beast. It was something to talk to. "So, you got her at last, huh?" he said drunkenly. "Ate her right up and swallowed her?" His laugh was a low gurgle. serves her right, that does, forgetting silly notions. She'd have found fault with anything. She would. I'm glad you got her. Glad your insides were big enough to hold her. Yes, sir. That's poetic justice. The bureau was half in shadow. Even the visible portions of it were shadowed, ill-defined, so that no separate details were distinct. It was more massive than usual tonight, because the green light was dimmed by the drizzling rain. Last night, when there had been no rain, the hulk had been a huge, staring hound. The night before that, it had been a fantastic horse with many malformed heads. Well, there was nothing strange about that. Almost any object of furniture could assume changing shapes in semi-darkness. The extent of the shapes depended entirely on the strength of the observer's imagination. The plump man chuckled to himself. He had a good enough imagination. It had come in handy, too, not so very long ago. Right now, it was a blessing. It kept him from thinking too much about certain unpleasant things which had occurred recently. He studied the bureau lazily. It had assumed a different shape tonight, probably because of the rain. It had eyes, several of them. They were the protruding knobs of the drawers. It had thick, misshapen legs, too, and a bloated torso. What would Bellini, the goggled-eyed chap downstairs, say to that? Most likely, he'd look with wide eyes and shudder and whisper warnings in his thin, womanish voice. Bellini was like a lot of other superstitious fools. He made too much out of nothing. Sentimental idiot. If he knew what the bureau contained, he'd run screaming back to his stuffy apartment at the back of the building and hide himself there. Well, he won't know, the plump man said indifferently. That's our secret, huh, old boy? When we move out of here in a few days, we'll take it with us. Then let them learn the truth, if they can. Still drunk, he saluted the bulging shape in the corner. Then he dragged the bedclothes around him and punched his knees into his stomach and went to sleep. Pale sunlight was streaking the walls of the room when he awoke. He lay motionless many minutes, aware that his mouth was dry and swollen and his head aching. Someday, he reflected wearily, somebody would discover a way to take the hangover out of hard liquor. He put both hands to his forehead and pressed hard, then rubbed his eyes with the heels of his palms. What time was it? About 10 o'clock, probably. It was hard to tell because the sunlight in the room was so feeble. Stiffly, he climbed out of bed and groped for a pair of slippers, then scuffed noisily into the kitchenette and opened the icebox door. While he was thumbing the cork out of a gin bottle, the door at the end of the hall rattled. Scowling, he paced back along the corridor and fumbled with a knob. "Who is it?"
"Me. Bulks," said the man outside.
The plump man opened the door slowly and stood there, with the gin bottle dangling in his fist. The other man, the same who had offered to assist him last night, said hesitantly, "Thought I'd see if everything was all right, Colette. You were in pretty bad shape last night."
"I was drunk, huh?"
"You weren't exactly sober." The plump one scowled and stepped aside, grinning. "Come in, have a drink," he said. "Excuse the attire, I just got up." He closed the door and led his visitor down the hall, then motioned the man to a chair and went into the kitchen for two glasses. Returning, he said, "I guess your wife was shocked, huh?"
"Not at all."
The other man accepted the full glass and turned it idly in his fingers. He seemed unsure of himself. "She knows what you're going through. We all do. Can't blame a chap for hitting the bottle under such circumstances." He hesitated, stared at the plump man's bleary eyes. "But aren't you overdoing it, Colette? What do your wife say when she does come back?"
"She won't come back."
"Why so sure?" "I'm no fool." He upended the glass in his mouth and swallowed noiselessly. "When a man's wife walks out on him, Welts, there's a reason. She doesn't just go for a hike."
"You mean there's another man?"
"If there is, good luck to him."
"You're taking it hard, old boy."
"I'm no fool," Anthony Colette repeated. "When a man comes home and finds his wife's clothes and her bags gone, and the house empty, and a goodbye note on the bureau. You asked me yesterday why I didn't notify the police and have them find her. That's why."
The man named Walks put down his glass and stood erect. "Sorry, old man," he said. "I didn't know." He paced into the hall, stopped, turned again. "Anything I can do," he mumbled. He closed the hall door after him. Anthony Collett poured himself another drink. A little while later, he put on a lavender dressing gown and paced to the door. Stopping, he picked up the morning paper, then returned to the living room, sat in the oversized chair, placed a gin bottle, a glass, and a pack of cigarettes within reach on the smoke stand, and leisurely began to read the sporting pages. He was quite drunk again when Mr. Cesar Bellini from downstairs called upon him 2 hours later. So drunk, in fact, that he shook Bellini's hand warmly and said with a large grin, "Well, well, come right in." Mr. Bellini was not usually welcome. He was a tall, painfully slender young man with aesthetic features and untrimmed raven hair. He was a student, though what particular kind of student he was, Anthony Collett had never troubled to find out. Mr. Bellini was one of those queer artistic chaps. It was believed that he gave readings or something of the sort to people who came professionally to see him. "I've come to see if there's anything, no matter how insignificant, I can do for you," he said jerkily. He sat stiffly in a straight-backed chair, leaning forward toward Anthony Collett with his lean hands flat upon his knees. "His trousers need a pressing," Mr. Collett observed. "He also needed instructions on how to knot a necktie." The one acceptable thing about him was the pale blue silk handkerchief protruding from his breast pocket. It gave him an almost feminine air of daintiness. "What do you mean?" Mr. Collett shrugged. "You think you can find her for me?" "If I could," Bellini murmured, "I would." "Well, why can't you? You're a spiritualist or something, aren't you?" "A spiritualist? No, no, I am not that, Mr. Collett." "Well, what about the people who come to see you? They come to get readings and that sort of business, don't they?" "No, you are mistaken. They come for advice. They come with troubles in their hearts. Me, I look in their minds and tell them what they should do." "Oh, you're a psychologist, huh?" Mr. Collett grinned. "Psychopathist, rather, Mr. Collett." "Well," Mr. Collett said drunkenly, "go ahead. Do your stuff. I'm drunk. I ought to be easy." "It is a strange thing, drink," Bellini murmured, moving his head sideways over its protruding Adam's apple. "Some men, they drink to celebrate. They are happy. They wish to be happier. Others drink, like you, to forget a sadness. You are lonely, no?" "Oh, I got a pal," Mr. Collett declared warmly. "A pal? Here?" "Right in the next room, young feller. Come along." He stood up, swaying in an attempt to balance himself. "I'll show you." Bellini did not understand. He frowned, and the frown darkened his already dark eyes and bunched his brows together over his hooked nose. He suspected, apparently, that Mr. Collett's pal was an ephemeral being born of gin fumes. Silently, he followed Mr. Collett into the bedroom. "There," said Mr. Collett, pointing. "But I see nothing." "Not now you don't." "Of course not. It's only there at night." "At night?" Bellini frowned. "I'm afraid I do not." "Then let me explain, and you will understand." Mr. Collett sat importantly on the unmade bed and hooked the heels of his slippers on the wooden bed frame. Folding his arms around his upthrust knees, he grinned into his guest's face and hiccuped noisily. Then, without haste, he slyly proceeded to inform the thin young man of the nightly visitor, which, created by a combination of green light, shadow, and applied imagination, emanated from the massive bureau in the corner. And having finished a prolonged dissertation, he released his knees and sprawled back up on the bed, expecting to be amused, no end by Bellini's outburst of horror. The outburst was not forthcoming. Bellini peered at him thoughtfully a moment, as if wondering how much of the speech could justly be attributed to a bellyful of liquor. He then turned and studied the window, the bureau, and the respective arrangements of each to the other. Finally, he said, frowning, "That is a most dangerous game, my friend." Mr. Collett was disappointed. "Obviously so." He sat up blinking. He said petulantly, "Huh? Dangerous? You are, how do you say it, flirting with fire," Bellini declared. "You mean I'll be scaring myself?" "Perhaps. But it is not so simple. This thing which you are making out of nothing, this monster, which is one night a large dog, and another night a many-headed horse, and another night a horrific portent unlike any named beast. It is perhaps only a thing of lights and shadows, as you have told me, but you are playing foolishly with profound metaphysics, my friend, with ontology, with the essence of all being. You are a blind man, walking treacherous ways of darkness. Huh? Mr. Cole said again. I'm what? You are a fool, Bellini said simply. You do not comprehend. The imagination, it is a powerful force. It is a productive faculty seeking everywhere for truth. If there is no truth, it creates truth. This thing you are creating for your amusement, it is unreal, perhaps. But if you are too persistent, you will make it real. Sure, Mr. Collett agreed pleasantly. Then I could get it drunk like me, huh? And we'd be pals. Very well. It's a good joke. My friend, it is good to be unafraid. That is because you do not understand. Yesterday, a woman came to me and said, I had a dream, and in my dream, my son came to me and bent over me and spoke to me. How is that? He is dead. Can the dead return? And I said to her, yes, the dead do sometimes return. But the man who came to you was a real man. You created him by thinking of him. He spoke the words you, yourself, put into his mouth. If you had willed him to kiss you, he would have kissed you. That is what I told her, and it is true. The same is true with you. When you create the strange portent in your mind, it is a reality. It is what you make it. It does what you will it. Suppose I will it to get me a drink, Mr. Collett murmured gently. Very well. You're making a fool of me. I will go. But you are the fool, my friend. You are toying with the very essence of life. I hope you are not so drunk one night that you mistake life for death. Apparently it was not difficult to anger Bellini's Latin temperament. His dark eyes burned. He turned deliberately and stared at the huge bureau. If I were you, he said bluntly, I would move that were lights and shadows in your fertile imagination. He spoke the word with significant emphasis. Would no longer transform it into something other than what it is. Good day, my friend. Mr. Collett swayed forward, protesting. Now, wait a minute. I didn't mean to poke fun at you. Good day, Bellini repeated coldly. I do not enjoy being made the idiot. To a man so drunk as you, all wisdom is a waste of time. I will come again, perhaps when you are more sober. The hall door clicked shut behind him. Mr. Collett sat on the bed, blinked foolishly at the bureau a moment, and said gravely, Now see what you've done? You scared the nice man away. Mr. Collett was neither drunk nor quite sober when he let himself into the apartment that night. He had spent most of the evening at the theater around the corner, and the offering there had been unpleasantly sinister. The silver screen reflected Mr. Collett was apparel sadly in need of censorship. It should be against the law to show certain pictures to certain people. Tonight's presentation had made him shudder. He did not recall the name of the picture, but the majority of its scenes had been of a strikingly weird nature. One in particular was so vivid in his mind even now that it made him uneasy. Oh, he grunted. I can see it yet, that damn thing. The thing which bothered him had been a monster, a manufactured monster, to be sure, created by experts out of immense sheets of rubberized cloth and animated by internal gears and levers, but horrible nevertheless. He had visions of it advancing toward him, as it advanced upon the unfortunate villain in the picture. Such things, he decided, should be outlawed. The time now was 11 o'clock. After leaving the theater, he had visited the businessman's club and vainly attempted to drive away his morbidity by batting a small white ping-pong ball across a table in the game room. Tiring of that, he had won $7 playing poker and had spent the $7 on a quart of excellent rye whiskey. He needed the whiskey. It would steady his nerves. For the past several days, his nerves had needed constant attention and lubrication. He took the bottle from his pocket and placed it gently on the radio, beside his wife's photograph. Methodically, he removed his tie, shirt, trousers, and shoes, and went to the bedroom for his dressing gown. Then he turned on the radio and sat in the overstuffed chair with a book in his lap. He opened the book. It was a mystery story. He liked mystery stories. This one would take his mind off his own troubles and make him forget himself. He reached for the bottle and looked about for a glass. Finding none, he shrugged his hunched up shoulders and upended the bottle in his mouth, drinking noisily. Then, grinning, he began to read. Reading, he became aware presently that the dance music emanating from the radio had become something less pleasant. Voices rasped at him. He listened a moment, scowling, then leaned forward abruptly to turn the dial. But instead of turning it, he listened again. It was one of those things you just had to listen to. There was a sound of wind howling and rain beating eerily upon the windows. There were voices whispering. The voices ceased. Into the strange silence came the ominous tread of slow footsteps. Clump, clump, clump. Mr. Collett grunted and turned the radio off. He leaned back in his chair, trembling. For a while, he stared with wide eyes at the photograph of his wife. Then, with an obvious effort, he focused his attention on the book in his lap. Before he had read half a page more, he snapped the book shut and dropped it on the floor. "Damnation," he said. "Everywhere I turn, there's murder and horror. There had to be a law against such things. It's uncivilized." He stood up and drank deeply from the bottle. Snarling, he strode into the bedroom and switched on the light. His gaze wandered to the bureau in the corner. He said viciously, "Blast him and his big talk. It's his fault. He's the one who started this business." He was thinking of Bellini. Bellini's smoldering eyes and deliberate words plagued him. The single window was again wet with rain, and its drooling glass winked with many green eyes derisively. The glass was pretty, Mr. Collett thought. It was like a large moving tray in a jeweler's store. Each green-edged drop of water was a tiny precious emerald. "And I suppose if I sat down and imagined them to be emeralds," he grunted, "they'd be emeralds." "Yes, they would not." He smiled crookedly, then, as if relieved at thus finding a flaw in Bellini's reasoning, quietly he removed the rest of his clothes and went to the bureau. Opening the top drawer, he took out clean pajamas. Then he looked down at the lower drawers and tapped the bottom one with his naked foot. "Comfortable?" he said quietly. He unfolded the pajamas. They were green with white stripes. Methodically, he got into them and stood idly before the bureau, his elbows angling outward as he buttoned the green jacket front. The room was warm. Frowning, he walked to the radiator and turned a small handle on the side of it. Then he stood at the window, looking out. Across the way, the green neon sign was like giant handwriting in the drizzle. "Tonight's the last night I'll be looking at you," he said. "We're moving out of here tomorrow. Me and the hope chest here." He turned his head drunkenly to peer at the bureau. "Yep. It's safe enough for us to clear out now. The neighbors won't be suspicious. They'll think I'm just a poor lonely devil trying to forget." He was aware suddenly that the odor of his own breath, tinted with liquor fumes, was not the only odor in the room. There was another smell, less pleasant and more significant, a sour emanation suggesting decay, as of spoiled meat. Eyes narrowed and lips puckered slightly, he strode quickly to the bureau and stooped to bring his nostrils close to the lower drawers. When he straightened again, he stood staring, his hands pressing hard against his hips. "We'll be leaving tomorrow, all right," he muttered. "It won't be too soon at that. I have to burn incense in here before the moving men come." He went into the living room then and took the bottle he had left there on the smoke stand. Quietly, he turned out the light and the hall light too and paced back to the bedroom. He opened the window 6 inches at the bottom to let out that offensive odor. Then he went to bed. He did not sleep. The room was too warm, and that unpleasant smell of pollution was too much in evidence. He lay with his thoughts, and they were morbid thoughts, parading rapidly across the bed. First marched the memories of that night not so long ago, when he had knelt on the floor of this very room with a keen-edged kitchen knife in one hand and a hacksaw. But it was better to forget those things. Then came the neighbors, finding him drunk, asking him questions and offering their sympathies. "But she'll come back, Mr. Collett. Women are strange creatures. They do strange things, but they are just women after all. She'll come back." And again, "Don't worry, old boy. She hasn't walked out on you for good. We all have our little family troubles. You and she, well, You've been going it pretty hot and heavy for quite a while. We've all known it, but she'll get over it. And then Bellini. Damn Bellini. Mr. Collett drained the contents of his bottle and leaned over to place the empty container on the floor. He lay back, enjoying the pleasant sensation of warmth that crept through him as the liquor found its way into his internals. Bellini was a superstitious young idiot, nothing else. His ideas were soap bubbles filled with hot air. How could you bring something to life just by imagining it? He turned suddenly on his side and peered at the bureau. The room was darker than usual because the rain outside was a cold rain, and the combination of cold outside and warmth inside had fogged the window pane. The huge bureau in the corner was a mastodonic shape of gloom, cloaked at one end in the winding sheet of changing green light. It was neither hound nor horse tonight, Mr. Collett reflected. It was merely a swollen hulk with protruding eyes. What would Bellini say to that? Well, I won't look at the damn thing, he thought drunkenly. I'll pack off to sleep and forget it. But he looked, because the thing was fixed firmly in his mind and his eyes refused to remain closed. Again and again he cursed himself for looking. But when he was not looking, he was wondering what new shape the thing in the corner had assumed. And then his eyes opened again to find out. This was foolish, too, because the thing had not changed shape since he had first peered at it. It was still a huge, bloated monstrosity with short, stumpy protuberances for legs and a balloon-like excrescence for a head. Like the thing in the movies tonight, he thought suddenly and shuddered. The thing in the movies had been a gigantic abhorrence supposedly called into being by obscene incantations. In the end, it had deliberately and awfully devoured its creator. Recalling those things, Mr. Collett gazed with renewed interest at the similar monster in his own room. Then he shut his eyes and mumbled aloud, "Oh, I'll be giving myself DTs." For a while this time, he succeeded in keeping his eyes closed, but he did not sleep. His thoughts were too vivid and his mind too alert to permit sleep. He wanted a drink, but was secretly glad that the bottle was empty. He had already drunk too much. The liquor was keeping him awake instead of making him drowsy. It was keeping alive the unpleasant parade of thoughts which persisted in marching through his mind. Especially was it keeping alive that annoying vision of Bellini and the words that went with it. Against Mr. Collett looked at the monster and again shuddered violently. "My God," he murmured aloud, "I'd hate to bring you to life." The thought, expressed thus in blunt syllables, alarmed him infinitely more than when he had kept it to himself. He wanted all at once to recall it, lest the monster should take it seriously and heed the suggestion. He wanted, too, to get out of bed and turn on the light, thereby transforming the monster into its original form. But the light switch was terrifyingly far away, and to reach it would have to pass within a yard of the beast's bloated head. There were several other things he wanted to do, too. He wanted to shriek at the thing to stop glaring at him, and he wanted to go into the next room and look at the clock to see how long it would be before daylight filtered through the green glowing window. Fearfully, he considered the wisdom of tiptoeing to the window and drawing the shade to shut out that green glare. But if he did that, the room would be in total darkness, and the horror would still be there, even though invisible. He no longer thought about Bellini or about the other things which lay in the bureau's lower drawers. He thought only of himself, and of his increasing terror. It was a foolish terror. He knew it was a result of going the wrong kind of movie and listening to a mystery play on the radio and reading a weird detective story and guzzling too much liquor. But those things were done now, cannot be amended, and the monster was here, threatening him. "But it's only wood," he mumbled. "It's not real." If he got up and walked toward it and touched it, his fear would be gone, and he would be laughing at himself for being a drunken fool. That would be the end of that, and he could turn on the light and go to sleep in security. But if the thing were real, if it were not made of wood and he walked toward it, another thought came then, caused him to cringe back into the wall. She had sent it. She had created it. Just as the man in the movies had created his monster, the thing hated him for what he had done to her. It meant to kill him. He lay rigid, staring at it. Yes, it was moving, and it was moving of its own accord. Not because of the mist on the window pane. Its hideous head was swaying from side to side. Not much, but enough to be noticeable. Its small eyes were glaring maliciously. It was getting ready to attack him. The blood ebbed from Mr. Colet's face. Slowly, with caution born of the fear which ate voraciously into him, he drew aside, inch by inch, the bedclothes which covered him. Fearfully, he wormed his legs towards the edge of the bed and lowered them until his bare feet touched the floor. Not once did his wide eyes blink or his fixed gaze leave the greenish shape in the corner. If he could reach the threshold and slam the door shut behind him, there might be a possibility of escape. The hall door was but a few strides distant, and once in the hall he could run with all his might, shouting for help. Warily he rose to a sitting position and put his hands behind him, pushing himself up. An eternity passed while his trembling body straightened and stood erect. Then he hesitated again, stifling the groan that welled to his lips. The thing was eyeing him malevolently. It was not a creature of his imagination. It was real. He knew it was real. Its horrible head had stopped swaying. Its bloated, swollen body was slowly expanding and contracting. It was waiting for him to make the first move. If he attempted to escape, if he took a simple forward step, it would fall upon him. Frantically, he wrenched his gaze away from it and glanced toward the doorway. The door was open. His only chance lay in that direction. If he waited any longer, he hurled himself forward. Three steps he took, and on the fourth he stood rigid, paralyzed by the sucking, scraping sound which rose behind him. He turned terrified, and the thing seized him as he recoiled from it. The impact flung him to the floor. For a single horrific instant, he stared up into the loathsome, undulating countenance above him. A scream jangled from his throat. Then his eyes and nose and mouth were smothered under an emanation of putrescent vileness, and that cavernous maw engulfed him. 8 hours later, the janitor discovered him there. The janitor, red-faced, large-stomached Swede, of more than middle age, shuffled past Mr. Colet's door with a garbage pail in his one hand and a mound of newspapers in his other. He had reached the midpoint in his daily round of collections. He wondered why Mr. Colet had failed to put out a wastebasket. Then he became aware of a most unpleasant and nauseating odor, which filled the corridor. And because a stench seemed to emanate from Mr. Colet's apartment, he knocked on Mr. Colet's door. A moment later, he let himself in with his own key. He found Mr. Colet in the bedroom. Midway between bed and doorway, Mr. Colet was dead. His legs and torso lay in a pool of dark red blood, and the entire upper portion of his plump body had been devoured. Those parts of him which remained were shapeless and unrecognizable beneath a pall of viscous green slime, and this foul excretience, whose unbearable stench had first attracted the janitor's attention, extended from Mr. Colet's mutilated body to the bedroom window, where the sill was likewise coated with it. These things the janitor saw, and at first failed to assimilate. Unable to comprehend such horror, he merely stood staring. Then, believing his eyes at last, he shouted incoherent words in a guttural voice, then leaned back against the wall, retching. Later, a sober-faced Frenchwoman, who was a modiste, sat in Mr. Colet's living room and said to the policemen who were questioning her, "I have told you all I know. There I was, sitting in my apartment across the court from this one, and I heard a man screaming. I put down my needle and thread and hurried to the window, and I saw the thing coming out of his man's window. I do not know what it was. There was rain falling, and I saw only what the green light from the advertising sign showed me. It was large, and it was greenish. That is all I am sure of. So large was it that it seemed to fold together as it flowed over his windowsill, and then stretched itself out like a big fat slug when it crawled over the edge of the roof up above. That is all I know." "But what in thunder was it?" one of the policemen demanded irritably. Mr. Bellini, the aesthetic-faced young man from downstairs, said quietly, "If you will come again into the bedroom, gentlemen, I will show you what it was." And when they had followed him there, he pointed unemotionally to the huge bureau in the corner and said, "It was a monster he made out of this. It destroyed him because he learned somehow to fear it, and fearing it, he willed it to do what it did." "Huh?" mumbled one policeman. "Feared it? Why? That I do not know. Well, we'll damn soon find out, the policeman snapped. Give me a hand here, Jenkins. Beginning with the top drawer, the two policemen removed the bureau's contents. They did so carefully, inspecting each item before dropping it to the floor. In the third drawer from the bottom, they found, wedged far back and buried beneath heavy articles of wearing apparel, a woman's arm, wrapped in an oblong of torn sheeting, which was caked with congealed blood. In the next drawer, they found four more blood cake packages, which they unwrapped with increasing horror. In the last drawer of all, they found a single large bundle, which contained a woman's head. Mr. Bellini, standing as near them as they would permit, gazed calmly into the woman's rigid feature and said without emotion, "It is his wife."